You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, hey.
And Evan Bernstein.
Chag Pesach Sameach, everyone.
What?
Yes, back at you. Back at you, Evan.
Thank you. But not with so much spittle. Thank you. Yes, that means happy festival of Passover to everyone.
Yay, tonight. The firstborn son of every firstborn son in Egypt is going to die.
Right? Oh, that's right. That's what they did back then.
Oh, amongst other things.
Crazy.
It was a tough
time
to live way back when.
Mm. Do you know, I was at Trader Joe's today and I saw they had like a little tasting table. And I live in a very Jewish neighborhood. So today's special was matzah and blueberry jam that had corn syrup in it.
Yeah.
Which I don't think is kosher. Evan, can you comment on that?
What do you know from kosher?
It's fine. Corn syrup's fine.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, the limitation on Passover is that you can't have anything that's leavened. You can't have anything with yeast that rises in order to acknowledge the fact that the Jews were wandering around the desert for so long. They didn't and they had to get out of Egypt fast. They didn't have time for the loaves to rise, as it were. You signify that by eating the matzah, you know, which is like basically a big saltine. But you're allowed to put stuff on it or in it or so forth. Oh, you know what?
We what is that, matzah?
We bought some chocolate-covered matzah. Oh, man, is that
what?
Stuff
What, Evan?
Good.
What are you... What?
Chocolate-covered matzah. Chocolate's perfectly fine during this
chocolate?
Holiday
If
season.
You put chocolate on almost anything, it tastes better than without it. I mean, that goes without
that
saying.
That is true.
Just to clarify, the whole wandering 40 years in the desert, that's commonly understood to be a total myth, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, most things having to do with... just about everything having to do with Passover is... none of it can be traced to any real... You know, definitive sources
can be verified or historically, right?
No plagues.
The story of Passover was written many, many years, decades, centuries, maybe perhaps even after the story supposedly all occurred. So it was all, you know, folklore that was handed down. The different tribes of Israelites and Jewish people each had kind of their own versions of stories. So what you have is like a mishmash of a whole bunch of different things from a lot of different tribes of Jews that took place, you know, many, many years prior. And of course, like all stories, and there's no written record of any of these accounts, you know, it's there's nothing you can point to validate anything.
No video?
No video, you know, even though those ancient Egyptians had all that space technology and stuff.
Right.
You think they would have been capturing the moment, but they fell down on the job.
So, Evan, since you're already in the spotlight, why don't you tell us what Dennis Lee has been up to?
Oh, well, talk about not being kosher. I mean, this
Ba-dum-bum.
Guy. See how I segued from one to the other?
It was brilliant. It was actually brilliant.
Oh, all right. So do we all know who Chris Hansen is? NBC?
We've seen
his... Yeah, it's from the Hansen brothers, right?
Jay knows him very well.
I do.
He's
an investigative reporter for NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. And you might have known him or seen him for his series To Catch a Predator, you know, in which he goes out and they hunt down these people trying to solicit underage people for sex and so forth, and they catch him in the sting. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
So when he's not doing that, he's off investigating other low-life people such as Dennis Lee. Just this past Sunday, they aired a special on Dateline NBC having to do with Dennis Lee's latest claim, his latest invention, called the HAFC, the Hydrogen Assist Fuel Cell.
Right.
Which is, quote, nothing short of revolutionary.
He's a copycat. It's a copycat. These things have been around.
The claim is that you hook this device up to your car, to your engine, and you're going to get 50% better mileage, gas mileage.
Right.
From your car, at least 50%.
That seems almost too good to be true.
Dennis guarantees it. He says so on his promotional tape. I guarantee 50%.
Yeah.
You know, remember that. So what Chris Hansen did with his team of investigators is they went out, they purchased one of these devices, had it installed in a car, in a Honda Accord. Before they did that, actually, they went off and verified the gas mileage of the car before the modification and the emissions, and they got all that data. And then they hooked up Dennis Lee's thing to the car and went back and tested it again, and there was absolutely no difference.
Zero
change.
In fact, there was a
slight decrease in gas mileage. Of course, Chris Hansen, and only he can, goes back and confronts the fellow who did the installation, a mechanic by the name of Sam Burlam, and he was pretty much like,
Well, that's not right. Are you sure, you had it tested right? It was an EPA, you know, basically test.
I thought she was 18.
And the best part of the whole segment, and it is available online, and Steve, we'll link to that, yeah, right, so that folks
absolutely
can actually watch the whole segment online, is that Chris confronted Dennis Lee, went over to his house. Apparently he lives in the greater New York area somewhere. Went to his house, and Dennis Lee came out, and they had a little spat.
Well, first, it was beautiful. At first, his wife answers the door, and then just slams the door in the guy's face and locks the door.
you can hear the clicking of the bolt. Click, slam.
She's clearly had some experience.
Yeah, right. Not again with the investigative reporter.
The bottom line is, this is Dennis Lee up to his same old shenanigans of promising these wonderful inventions, makes all these bold claims. He suckers in people to either buy his franchise or become, you know, certified installers of these kits. People pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to be certified to do these installations, and then they can go ahead and sell it to the customer and make their money back that way. But in the meantime, Dennis is making all this money, mm-hmm, and the things just simply do not work.
Yeah.
Now, what he claims is that this device is a device that electrolyzes water using an onboard cell, and it burns the hydrogen-oxygen mix in the engine. And then the theory is that the burning of the hydrogen will provide the extra energy that results in better gas mileage, right? So
right,
turning water into fuel or energy. And it's just, you know, it doesn't happen.
Here's one thing that I thought the piece missed. They said that it doesn't create enough hydrogen to create a significant fuel advantage. But that's actually not what's wrong with that claim. What's wrong with that claim is it violates the second law of thermodynamics. It costs more energy to split the water than you get when you burn it together again with the hydrogen with the oxygen again. You have to lose energy when you hydrolyze and then reburn hydrogen. That doesn't work. This is a flawed concept. It's had a million manifestations. You know, every crank thinks they can, you know, get more gas mileage or run a car off water by electrolyzing it and burning the hydrogen. It doesn't work, and it has to do with thermodynamics, period. It's totally fraudulent.
Bob Park had a great quote. He said that regarding Lee, he said that he's broken a lot of laws, but he hasn't broken the laws of physics yet.
Right. And just to put things into context with Dennis Lee, this guy is a perennial con artist. He is a sociopathic con artist. He just comes up with lie after lie after lie, all these devices that are completely fantastical, perpetual motion machines, and then he sells it with a mixture of patriotism and we're doing this for God, right? So it's basically religion and patriotism, and of course conspiracy theories, of course the man and big oil. And in fact, he accused Chris Hansen of being a shill for big oil.
Oh boy.
Just out of the blue.
That's all he knows. That's all he knows what to say. You know, you're part of the big conspiracy that's holding little guys like me back, and
right,
you know, we have the answers, and you just don't want to see it happen.
It's a total con. And it's amazing this guy's, you know, in and out of trouble with the FTC. The FTC is investigating him again for this. But it's amazing that he's just not in jail for life, you know, or banned from doing anything like this forever. I mean, how this guy could still be selling these franchises and fraudulent devices at this stage is amazing to me.
It's like a Kevin Trudeau situation.
Absolutely. It's identical.
And we've brought this up before. This is one of those things. At some point, there has to be a threshold where the person gets shut down.
Yeah.
You know, just like we put people in prison, right, for committing a certain level of crime or whatever, like, why don't we have these things in place?
Well, but the analogy I draw is to the RICO laws. So there are racketeering laws where it looks at the big picture. It's like, okay, you have these individual crimes, but when you put it all together, this is part of a larger racketeering conspiracy. And then once you cross that threshold, as you say, Jay, then you go down for with much greater, you know,
fines and jail times for under RICO. There needs to be a similar kind of law for chronic, you know, recurrent con artists.
It's, yeah.
Even though you might not be able to get them on for too much on the individual crimes, once you pass a certain threshold, you're incorrigible. That's it. Huge jail time, huge fines, and banned for life from ever taking investments or doing whatever it is that you do. That's what we need.
I agree.
Me too.
He's got some outstanding, you know, issues in a whole list of states, but he can just continue to move around and move his operation, and you know, he'll do this till the day he dies,
right,
basically.
Right. And we'll keep an eye on him, and every now and then we'll update on what's going on.
Oh, if he ever comes back to Connecticut, we should try to confront him.
Oh yeah, again. Oh yeah.
That was interesting. We had our own.
Yeah, you and Perry, right? Went to his show and confronted him directly. I remember Perry was passing, told me the story. He loved the story that he was passing out, you know, the sheets of paper that we printed up with, like, Dennis Lee's criminal past, and and one of Dennis Lee's lackey, you said to Perry, "What about your criminal past?" Perry was like, "What?" It's like, just make up accusations against your critics. That's it. There we go.
Well, that's a very Scientologist thing to do. That's
exactly
what they do. Like, well, you're a pedophile. It's like, what? No.
It is. There are some cult. Definitely some cultish qualities that go along, you know, with the whole Dennis Lee phenomenon.
Yeah. Bob, tell us about the computer that does science.
This is some cool stuff here. The past week saw two related news items that I think could lead to game-changing tools for scientific discovery. The first was a computer program. It's just software that basically examined the data derived from things like pendulums and double pendulums and things like that, and in a day essentially deduced laws of motion that took scientists centuries to determine themselves. Now, this program was created by Cornell University computational researcher Hod Lipson and computational biologist, which is an interesting title, Michael Schmidt, and they describe their efforts in a recent issue of Science. Hod Lipson says that this is one of the biggest problems in science today is moving forward and finding the underlying principles where there's lots and lots of data. You know, you've got just reams and reams of data that scientists are trying to pour through, but there's a theoretical gap. We're not sure exactly what's going on. He thinks this could be a really important tool for digging into this data and finding patterns that humans are just completely overwhelmed by. Now, you think of the software program, you know, what is this thing? It's not an expert system. It doesn't have an a priori model of what it's looking at. It basically consists of these very, very simple building blocks like groups of processes like addition and subtraction and division and some algebraic operators. Basically, it's just those random or near random, as they describe them, groups of these processes, and then you add them to the data set, and it kind of works with the data set, and it creates output. And the output is essentially equations that attempt to explain the data.
Is it an algorithm, Bob, or is it really doing it?
It's an algorithm, but what it is, it's a genetic algorithm. And if you're familiar with them, you'll know what's going on. The initial result is they're usually totally wrong. It produces these equations, and essentially they're all wrong. But some of them are a little bit less wrong than the other ones. So in a typical genetic algorithm style, they take the best ones, they modify them a little bit in some random way, and then the cycle repeats over and over, evolving the equations until they can duplicate the data set or even predict it. So it's basically a genetic algorithm that evolves the output equations until they got something that's right. And which I thought was an incredible idea, and they really made some progress with this. Lipson said that if you look at the data plainly, it's difficult to see if there's anything systematic going on there. So if you just look at this data, you know, I'm not talking about looking at, say, the pendulum, looking at the data that's produced from these devices. And if you look at it, it's easy to get completely overwhelmed by it. But despite all that, he said that the algorithm, when it analyzed the data, it could see the laws that we know are correct, because obviously they applied it to things that we already know so that we can immediately determine, they're definitely onto something. Then the scientists did something really cool. It made me happy when I read this because it was such a classic move. They fed the algorithm random numbers, which was an excellent idea. So what do you think happened when they put random numbers in there?
The computer said, what the hell is this?
It said, Norman coordinate.
The computer correctly found nothing. Now, if it found something, then you've got a problem. But what an awesome test.
Yeah,
That's one of the distinguishing characteristics of real scientists. You try to shoot down your own shit. That's what you got to do.
Yeah.
Do you think any of those Bible code people ran their programs against random letter combinations? I don't think so. Because if they did, they would have realized, well, wait, random letters can produce all this.
Yes, exactly.
Words just like anything else can. So, of course, if they did it, they didn't tell anybody about it. So that,
well, they randomly prayed to Jesus about it, Bob.
There you go. So what's the future? I think, as you might guess, that it's got
Matrix.
A pretty interesting
future.
I'm having
dinner tomorrow night.
I think scientists are going to be increasingly partnering with programs like this to evaluate data sets that are just simply too complex for humans to deal with, because we're approaching that.
So is this kind of algorithm going to spit out the solution to string theory someday?
That's hard to say. The potential is certainly there.
And if it does, will we understand it?
Well, I hope we do, but there's just certain things. It's like you've heard the analogy of trying to teach a dog algebra. I don't care if you've got the brightest dog on the planet. There are just certain things that a dog can never, in principle, really understand or get a handle on. And this could actually help us, I think, get a handle on certain things that we just really wouldn't be able to do without any help. And that's pretty much what computers are anyway. It's just an extension. It's a way to extend human cognition and our reach.
It's also a step in a direction where things are going to progress from here. You know, they're not going to just say, okay, so now we got this and we're not going to enhance this or make it smarter or, you know, add functionality to it. I mean, to me, this article is much more about indicating what we're going to be able to do in the future.
Well, some scientists say that it has such great potential that you can apply this to any type of dynamical system, which is pretty broad statement. I mean, that includes environmental systems, weather patterns. Martha Pollack says that she's a University of Michigan computer scientist. She said just about any natural science has a type of structure that would be amenable to this. But on the other hand, you've got the University of Minnesota cognitive neuroscientist, Michael Atherton. He said that the creativity, expertise, and the recognition of importance is still dependent on human judgment. And he's correct. At this stage, we absolutely are. The main problem remains the same: how to codify the complex frame of reference. Now, Lipson himself had a similar sentiment when he said, in the end, we still need a scientist to look at this and say, that's interesting. And that's very true. So yes, humans are still important. The real question is, for how long?
Was that last statement a criticism of the achievement or not?
No, just kind of trying to put it into perspective and bring it down to earth a little bit, that it's, you know, that people aren't out of the loop. Obviously, there's no computer around yet that can say something is interesting or worthy, which is such a judgment call.
Well, what if people, you know, eventually are taken out of the loop? Let's say that the software is running that comes up with a lot of information, and another program determines whether or not, you know, determines how viable or useful the information is, and there's a feedback loop there, and we are.
Well, yeah.
One
big clue to that, Jay, well, I think we'll know, is if when they start calling it Skynet, then that's a big, you know.
Yeah. But that's the Kurzweil scenario, right, where you have computers that are artificially intelligent and think a million times faster than people. They'll be doing science a million times faster than we're doing it right now.
Right.
And that's where things really get interesting.
Yeah, and that's not just Kurzweil. It's a lot of people are saying that – Once that happens, it will get interesting really fast. And some people, they describe that as a singularity, is when really going to
strike. An alternate sort of path is that, and I think Kurzweil mentioned this also, is that it's in, at the time this is happening, it may also be the case that it won't be scientists and their computers, which are tools, but the scientists will be the computers, meaning that we will merge our biological brains with our computer technology. So the artificially intelligent machines of the future will be us, in effect.
Well, that goes without saying. Bob.
Jay!
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Bob.
That was good, Jay. But, Steve, in this scenario, there really is no artificial intelligence required. It's just basically...
Right. It's an algorithm. There's no artificial intelligence.
Right.
Let's do some questions in email.
The first one comes from Jason Brown from Idaho, and Jason writes, "Last year I was visiting my mom, and she had an appointment with some people to come over and check her house because they could save her money on her electric bill. Of course, when they showed up, I was immediately asking for specifics about what they did. They had all kinds of fancy words and equipment, but here is the gist. The lady plugged a device with a small LCD screen into the wall socket and said, 'Ooh,' then told me that the current in the line was jumping up and down really bad. She also threw in some wave and differential words. She then plugged a capacitor into another plug on the same circuit and showed me her little LCD readout, which had dropped to near zero. She told me that the capacitor would store all that wasted energy, noise, and smooth out the flow in the lines, then release it later, thus saving up to 30% on your energy bill.
Wow.
I was astounded mostly that my mother and stepdad would let these people within 100 yards of their front door. There are so many reasons why this is bunk, the most obvious being that if it works, this guy should be richer than the entire Middle East. Have you ever heard about this one? Sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but I found a similar one that he links to KVAR Energy Savings. The difference is that the ones my parents were installing just plugged into your wall socket. Great show. Keep up the good work."
I didn't know Dennis Lee was doing house calls.
Yeah, this is a Dennis Lee type of scam. So I looked into this, and I actually wrote about it and got a lot of good feedback from some electrical engineers. So this is an interesting story.
And before you go on, can I just point out that the website, KVAR Energy Savings, everything on that webpage is completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's a picture of four people in business suits jumping up in the air. There's an ad seen on TV.
Yeah, it's got all the red
flags randomly thrown in. It's pretty ridiculous all around.
So here's the skinny in terms of the science behind what they're claiming. In an electrical circuit, there are two types of forces at work. There is resistive force, and that's the force that does work, meaning there's a resistance to the flow of the electricity in the circuit, and that resistance is due to the fact that the electricity is being made to do work, like light a light bulb, turn a fan, run a motor, whatever. There's also something called reactive force. Reactive force derives from asynchronies in the current and the voltage, is a simple way to put it. And it's essentially the efficiency of the current flowing through the lines. If the current and the voltage are out of balance, if they're out of phase, this results in this reactive force, which does waste energy, right? That is true. That's the one kernel of truth in this, that a reactive force will waste energy. So what they're claiming is that they can balance the voltage and the current in such a way that it reduces the reactive force, reduces the inefficiency in the circuit, and therefore you do not waste energy and you save money. Sounds pretty good. And if you weren't an electrical engineer or you weren't inherently skeptical and did your homework, it sounds like that much sounds perfectly reasonable. The red flag that it's going to save you 30% on your electricity bill is the kind of thing that any skeptic should have their ears perk up. And as Jason said, why isn't this guy a millionaire? Or what I wrote is, why isn't this something that's being mandated by the states, by the government, by the electric companies? Why isn't this in every house? You know, why isn't there a tax rebate if you get one of these things attached to your house? Can you imagine?
Conspiracy.
Like, could you imagine if we could save 30% of our, like, just of all domestic electricity use? I mean, we're having problems with our energy grids and brownouts in certain areas. I mean, think about it. It's ridiculous.
It's an easy explanation. It's just a conspiracy, yeah. You know.
Well, here's the reason why it's not a conspiracy. It's also part of the reason why it's not going to save you any money. The electric companies, you know, they charge you for whatever is going by on the meter, right? The meter is – but what's the meter measuring? The meter is measuring only resistance in your circuit. It's not measuring the reactive force, which means you're not being charged at all for any electricity wasted due to reactive force in the circuit. The electric companies lose 100% of the money from the electricity that is wasted through reactive forces. That means if they could reduce the reactive force, they wouldn't lose revenue because they wouldn't be losing – because no one's paying for it anyway. They would just be losing inefficiency. They would be earning money, right? They would be more profitable if they could, which means, again, they would have it on every transformer at every house if it actually could save them money. Here's another point is that electric companies sometimes charge industrial users for a penalty for reactive forces in their circuits, right, or in their equipment. And they do measure it. And, for example, a reactive force is one, meaning that there's no inefficiency, there's no energy loss due to imbalances between the voltage and the current, right? So that would be a one, meaning they're exactly the same. Zero would be 100% loss. So if you have it at 0.8, the electric company may charge you for that, for the 0.8 being below one. And therefore, theoretically, a private company might benefit from this kind of device. But these devices that are being sold don't really do anything, the capacitor that you throw into the circuit. And this is why. When you add a capacitor to the circuit, essentially what happens is it takes electricity from the circuit to charge up the capacitor, and then it gives it back to the circuit later. But there's no net change in energy. The energy is just flowing in and flowing out of the capacitor. Yeah, it might make your squiggly lines on your LCD flatten out.
Yeah, so what the capacitor is doing is it's taking electricity and then feeding it back in when there's a dip, right?
Yeah, but it's doing it to the whole circuit. Therefore, it may make for a good demonstration to convince the uninitiated, but it's not actually doing anything to the efficiency of your whole circuit. The reason is that if it's plugged into the circuit when energy is not being drawn from the circuit, it actually makes it less efficient. It actually costs you energy. So therefore, you would only want it to be active for each device when that device is being used and only when it's being used. Therefore, this kind of technology would be useful, for example, if it was built into your refrigerator and it balanced the demand of voltage and current for the refrigerator, and it turned on when the refrigerator was on and was basically designed to optimize the efficiency of the electricity used by that one appliance. And guess what? They're already in the devices, right? If you have an Energy Star compliant refrigerator, it already has one of these devices built into it in the electronics. So any high-end electronic device is already going to have this technology taken advantage of in the device itself. But adding it to the whole circuit, probably, if anything, is going to decrease the efficiency of the whole circuit because it's not going to be able to adjust to the demand of each device on the entire in your house, for example, right? Or on whatever circuit you have off of your circuit breaker. So those two little things, the electric company doesn't charge you for reactive forces and the device doesn't do anything anyway, and to the extent that it does work, it has to be built into a specific device, and it already is on a high-end Energy Star device, right? So these things are a complete and total scam, 100%.
The electric company.
Right.
Steve.
Scam.
Can you start at the beginning there?
It was cool because I was able to wrap my mind around this mostly, but then when I wrote about it on my blog, I asked electrical engineers, to add some detail, and they were very nice in explaining it in a little bit more detail and fleshing out some of the things that I missed, so it was good. But I think that's a pretty complete story about why this is total bunk.
Oh, I'd say it was complete.
Yeah. But the thing to keep in mind on a more generic level is if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And if you just go through that thought process, if this could really save me 30% of my electric bill, why isn't everybody doing it? Why isn't it mandated? If you could put a pill in your gas tank and save 50% of your fuel, come on. The government would be all over this. It's ridiculous.
What are you trying to say? What's that?
Just ask yourself, why do they have stock photographs of people in business suits jumping up and down? Why?
They're excited. Why? They're happy.
Yay, we got scammed.
Yeah. Yay.
Go team.
You read like that 80s movie, like at the end, jump in midair?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Jason. I love talking about scams for some reason. Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Daniel Loxton. Daniel, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Daniel is a very active skeptic, including the author of Junior Skeptic for Skeptic Magazine.
Officially, I'm the editor of Junior Skeptic. I do write most issues.
You do write most issues?
I also illustrate all of them, so.
Really? Cool.
Yeah.
And you're also working on some kids' books as well.
Yeah, one of which is out now, one of which should be out in the spring of 2010, and then several others that we have in other stages of production.
And your recent project, which is the main reason why you're talking with us this evening, is a book called What Do I Do Next?, which is you edit it, but it's a collaborative project with a lot of activist skeptics talking about what people can do to be active in the skeptics movement. So why don't you tell us about that project?
In 2007, I released an article, an op-ed essay called Where Do We Go From Here?, which was a kind of memo to the skeptical movement, calling for a renewed focus on skeptical activism and kind of core skeptical topics. That got a really large amount of feedback. But the very common question coming out of it that I'm ready to become a skeptical activist of some sort. I'd like to help. What do we do next? And this was not a new question either. I mean, you guys must get it all the time. I think all skeptics do. Mm-hmm. People will say, I'd like to help, but how? So I took that as a serious question and sat down to try and figure out how best to answer it. And I thought, well, it's an enormous question. So I thought about it quite a lot and eventually turned back to a little article in Skeptic Magazine that I had read by Andrew Main, the magician Andrew Main, which went through just point form 50 things that ordinary people could do. I thought, you know, that's a great place to start. So I, with his permission, created a longer list of over 100 items. Just, you know, things that you can personally do. You know, you can donate money to a skeptics group. You can get to work fixing Wikipedia. You know, over 100 of these types of practical things. And then I thought, you know, this really needs to be fleshed out because some of these are huge topics. You know, there's plenty of room for discussion on each one. So the next step was that I sent this out to a select list of skeptics from many organizations, many podcasts, more than one country, inviting skeptics to go through the list and comment or annotate each one of these items as they saw fit. Those comments all came in. I collated those together and then sent the whole thing out for another round of comments so people could comment on each other's comments. We did that several times. And then it went through several rounds of editing and proofing and that sort of thing, with the emerging document being a 30,000-word whopper.
Yeah, wow. And actually, Jay, you participated in that, right?
Yeah, I did. Daniel sent me an email, and I read most of the document that was in place at the time, and I just added my feedback in, and I had a really good time reading it, and I know pretty much everyone that contributed. And I just put in my 2 cents where I thought it was needed. And then when Daniel sent it out again to give us kind of a look at it before it went live, I read the whole thing and it took quite a while, but it's so chock full of information. There's so many, and everyone's coming from different angles too, because we're all like, you know, even though we're all skeptics, we all have a lot of different experience. I think it's really a cool thing. I love how it turned out, and I can't wait to get feedback on what people think about it.
Feedback is coming in now. It's, you know, as you'd expect, it's sort of a slow burn just because it's so enormous. It's 68 pages if you include the point form appendix. It's been getting quite a bit of press, including some somewhat surprising, unexpected things like Examiner.com and the This Week in Tech Netcast Network has covered it as well. And some interest overseas as well. I was just talking to the Italian skeptics today about translating it.
Yeah, it sounds like a good resource. So give us some of the meat. Was there any surprising feedback you got from the skeptics, or was there anything where you really didn't expect the kind of opinions that you were getting?
Well, there were a few items where I expected more controversy than I got, places where I injected my own personal hobby horses into the document on the front end and sort of expected that to get reversed as feedback came in, but they didn't. One being that we should really strive to keep in mind that skepticism and atheism are not the same topic. That was one that everybody seemed to be able to agree on, but I was a bit surprised about it because there are two camps on this in the skeptics movement.
Do you think that has to do with the people you chose to get feedback from, or do you think that over time the skeptical movement may be settling on somewhat of a consensus that we need to separate skeptical activism from atheist activism?
I think both are true. I mean, I did kind of rig the game by the people that I invited. You know, there are probably some higher ups at the Center for Inquiry who would have represented the other position if I'd asked them. I do think a sort of consensus is emerging. With the emergence of the new atheism and the kind of volume and power of that, people can see that there's a need for a distinction, just a practical need. As we go out in the world and we're talking to people, it's important that we be able to say clearly who we are and who we're, how we're different from other parallel movements.
Well, Daniel, when, if someone reads this and does have an opposing opinion, would they be able to send that in and contribute to maybe a second version or a second edition of some sort?
I'm absolutely hoping that that will happen. We've set up a whole new area at the Skeptic Forum, which you can access from the skeptic.com homepage, just to discuss skeptical activism and in particular this project. And I've set up a thread there just calling for criticism and reservations, things of that nature. But I hope that people will riff on it. I hope that people will challenge the items in there. I mean, if skepticism is for anything, it's for that. I don't think the conversation is over when we publish it. I think it's just the beginning, or I hope it is only the beginning.
It sounds like it would be a good project for like a Web 2.0 format, like a wiki format. Is that in the works, or have you considered that?
It's crossed my mind, but I haven't looked into it in any depth. Similarly, to translate such a large project is itself a big job, and I've been sort of meditating on ways to allow a lot of people to work on a translation job or, work on a number of translations. It's when you're looking at volunteers, you can only overburden them so much.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You said it was 30,000 words. That's quite a bit.
Even the point form version is something like 3,000 or 4,000 words. So,
well, Rebecca and I would be happy to translate it into street talk for you.
Yo yo yo! I totally do that word.
Could I hear another sample?
Could I translate it into the Jive edition? Is that what you're going to do?
I could do Cockney, actually. I'm really good at that.
A Cockney.
Oi, governor! Do something for skepticism. I don't know. Okay.
Don't open up that can of worms.
Maybe not.
Speaking of turning people away from skepticism, I can single out the one item on the list that is generating the most controversy so far, which is item number one, which is donate money to skeptical organizations. Not very many negative responses so far, but the ones that have come in are like, gee, I read that and I stopped reading. That was as far as I got. And I kind of knew that could happen. But I thought, why be coy about this? That actually is something that people can do to help. And the truth is that for the last, 30, 35 years, skeptical organizations have been doing a lot of the heavy lifting. So, I say this as somebody who works for a skeptical organization, but still, it's worth supporting them. And not just the big ones, but the little ones and the independent ones, most of them are nonprofits, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're not coy about it at all. We're a nonprofit educational organization. The amount of work that we can do is pretty much directly proportional to our resources. So, we ask our listeners to send us money all the time. It's like PBS asking for money, right? I mean,
exactly.
It's the same exact thing. This is all for free, commercial free, and all we ask is that you support it to whatever your inclination. That should not be controversial. That's absurd, in my opinion.
And mine as well, particularly since, the project, everybody involved donated their time, and then skeptic.com is giving it away for free. So, some of my time went into it. So in that case, it's a loss for a skeptic, and no one's really expecting anything in return. But if you should be inclined to support skeptical organizations, I certainly encourage it. So that's, I broke it down into sort of umbrella headings, like activism that you can do online. Political activism, ways to support schools or libraries. And the first of those umbrella topics is supporting skeptical organizations.
Let's go back a little bit, if you don't mind,
all right,
to Where Do We Go From Here, which, as you say, was your original essay. I remember I heard I heard you give that on Skepticality, the audio essay.
Too.
It was very good.
Thank you.
And that was basically about what the skeptical movement is and should be and how we should conceive of ourselves. Can you give us a summary of your main points there?
Well, it was born out of a sort of a frustration as I was looking around. This is 30 years into the skeptics movement, and I saw a kind of a crossroads where a lot of people who had been involved in the movement for a long time were just kind of shaking their head and saying, please God, not another story about Bigfoot.
That's a great way to put that. I love that.
I happen to love Bigfoot, but you know, I can relate to the sentiment that, you know, if we've been dealing with these same unsinkable rubber ducks for decades, you know, if not even a guy like Popoff can be kept down by exposure in front of millions of people, when do you give up? When do you move on to new topics? Mm-hmm. Normal is just played out. Maybe people don't believe as they used to. And looking, hearing that kind of sentiment expressed, I thought, you know, I think that's totally wrong. I think that the paranormal is as relevant as it is to, you know, as it has ever been. So I don't think that job is ever over. And it's also a job that nobody else does. No, you know, only the skeptics do anything about paranormal and fringe science claims. The law is almost totally impotent about these things. Regular media gives these things a pass or even elevates them to a kind of a believable status that they don't begin to deserve. So, you know, if you're looking around and seeing people get hurt, and I think people do get hurt in the paranormal, you know, who are you going to call, right?
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree, and mainstream scientists don't like to touch it. They feel it's not worthy of their attention, which there is some merit to that opinion. And I think a lot of mainstream scientists don't have the skill sets necessary to deal with it, because understanding science is not sufficient. And we see that all the time, where scientists think that understanding the science is sufficient. And then they get completely bamboozled by a con artist, or they get completely trashed in a debate with a creationist because they don't understand, you know, all of the things that go into this, which, you know, I tend to look at it, you know, just as my bias as an academic, as skepticism is an academic discipline unto itself with lots of skill sets that make it up.
I agree completely, as it happens. Skepticism is many things. You know, it can be a kind of an activist project. One of the things it is a kind of sub-discipline of history. You know, this is an area that you have hundreds, maybe thousands of topics under the heading of skepticism or the paranormal. Very few of those are areas that other historians are looking at in depth, let alone trying to analyze as fact claims. So that's an area that, you know, it's one of our services. It's one of the things that we do.
And in that first essay, you mentioned the kind of things that the skeptical movement does, like what our role is. And one of the things you mentioned was promoting science education, right, and public understanding of science and critical thinking. I think that's pretty non-controversial. We all agree with that. That's also, I think, the easiest thing to explain to other people. When I'm asked by somebody who has no clue what I do, what the skeptical movement is, that's what I always begin with. We promote science education and critical thinking to the public. I think that's the easiest thing for people to understand.
I do exactly the same thing. When somebody says, oh, a skeptic magazine, what's that? I say it is a science advocacy magazine. And yet, you know, on the one hand, it is a core function of skepticism to promote science, to advocate for the scientific way of looking at the world. But, you know, I actually think we perform quite poorly as science journalists. Your show is better than most, I have to say, partly because you personally come at it with so much scientific training. But there's a real weakness in the skeptics movement that we are sympathetic to the doubter's position, whatever the topic is. We want to side with the guys who say, hey, wait a minute, wait, you know, this is, I think you're trying to bamboozle me. So, you know, it makes the skeptics movement into an unlikely sort of haven for deniers of all stripes, which is, I think, a real ongoing problem.
And in what way do you think that's a problem? Can you be more specific?
Well, you know, if you look at a topic like global warming, I think that the skeptics' literature has trailed the mainstream press in accepting and promoting global warming, you know, accepting the state of the science. And that's given the fact that the mainstream press was vastly behind the technical literature, you know. The same is true for many topics, fluoridation, secondhand smoke. It's an area that so as soon as someone says I don't believe X, there's a subset of skeptics who are inclined to just assume that their position must have some merit, even when it's an extreme fringe position within the community of experts.
Mm. But although the examples that you gave, one thing that struck me is that the subset of skeptics that would be skeptical of those claims might be the libertarian subset of skeptics. Do you see that's how it shakes out generally, that libertarian skeptics will tend to be the ones that will be skeptical of any government claims or things like fluoridation or global warming?
I think it is how it shakes out. I say that with some caution because so many of our valued colleagues, some of the great leaders of skepticism, are sympathetic to the libertarian position. Which, you know, many of your listeners are not American. It's just going to sound like we're speaking Martian when we're talking about libertarianism, because it's a very U.S.-centric kind of a concept. But it does have traction in the U.S., and it has a remarkable amount of traction in the skeptics movement, to the degree where, you know, if we almost think it's natural for someone to say, I believe in science and reason and free markets. Mm-hmm. And it sounds normal to us because we're exposed to it so much. But if somebody, you know, the same percentage of skeptical leaders said, I believe in science and reason and that the means of production should be in the hands of the proletariat, it would just sound totally jarring.
Right.
I'm a little confused. Well, not confused. I'm a little surprised, I think, at your use of the term leader. And I think that's where I'm at a bit of a disconnect, because I never really... You know, I can see that there's a certain libertarian tendency amongst many skeptics, but I never really thought of people as skeptics leaders, because I think that in general, the skeptical population finds it very difficult to be led. And while they might be influenced more by one person or another, I guess the term leader implies something that I don't really see happening in the skeptical community. Is that something that do you see it as more of a traditional kind of movement with people who are leading the way and who are seen as some kind of heroes, or I don't know, what do you think of the skeptical leaders, I guess?
I see your question, and it's one that comes up quite often. And there's an important truth to it, that skeptics are resistant to leadership and resistant to organization, which is one of the reasons why I felt the What Do I Do Next document could have a certain value, that many distributed people doing their own thing could all independently refer to something and come up with ideas. Skepticism does resist leadership, but on the other hand, you know, people are people, and you've got this kind of power distribution of a few people who do a tremendous amount of the work and take up a lot of the prominence in the skeptics movement, and then many, many, many people who are mostly quiet or silent. And it happens that many of those people in the spike are libertarians. And we're human. We listen to our heroes. I have heroes. I think if they're honest, almost everybody listening would admit that there are voices in skepticism, or if they're not skeptics, in some other field that are influential to them.
Well, I think it's a typical intellectual community in that there aren't really leaders so much as people that are intellectually respected. But yeah. At the same time, part of that respect is the desire to engage with them, maybe even disagree or be critical of them. And that's all good, although it does lead to a situation where we do have a hard time organizing ourselves. And attempts at a top-down organization of the skeptical movement have failed over and over again, to the point where I think people have just given up.
I think it depends in part how you define failure. The guys over at the CFI are giving it a very serious run to create an institution, something that will have branches around the world, which will outlast the original leadership when they retire or pass away. And you know, although their primary interest seems to be humanism rather than skepticism, or they have a divided interest, you know, they are trying to build a top down kind of an institution. They're having some success, although I'd say that projects like yours are probably having more success in terms of demographics, that many, many people are listening in their own distributed way from the comfort of their own homes.
Right. On that point, I agree they're having success in doing their own thing, right?
Yeah.
They're creating
an
infrastructure for themselves. But I will say there was a point in time when they fairly overtly tried to absorb the local skeptical groups And that's what I really meant by a top-down organization. Not just organizing themselves internally and maybe spreading out from there, but actually trying to organize existing activist skeptics. And the differences that existed in the skeptical movement in terms of philosophy, like how much do we address religion and things like that, made it impossible to really to move forward with that. But getting back to the political thing, I agree with you made a point in your essay that the skeptical movement needs to be apolitical, and I 100% agree with that. Just like any scientific community needs to be apolitical, in my opinion. But I'm not sure I agree that there is a disproportionate amount of libertarians in the skeptical movement. From my perspective, I tend to see a fairly equal distribution of liberals and libertarians. That's how I would sort of characterize the movement as shaking down. And they often, in fact, come to conflict. I think it's one of the things that keeps the skeptical movement from being more cohesive, if you will. Having said that, I think that most skeptics do put their political differences aside and do acknowledge that they have more in common. But basically, it comes down to liberals and libertarians, and pretty much everyone knows who everyone is.
Yeah. Well, I would suggest that even just being able to break it down to liberals and libertarians already means that the libertarians are represented more in the skeptics movement than they are in the general population, particularly if you look at it globally. But even on the U.S. scene, I mean, libertarianism is really kind of a fringe political view. It's not terribly common in demographic terms. We're stuck with it for good or for bad. I think it's not wonderful, but some people really like it. So then the question is, how do we work together on these basic issues of harm reduction in the paranormal realm and on advocacy for science? And I agree that taking off our political hats as soon as we get to the skeptics table is a really important, necessary step.
Absolutely. And again, like you mentioned, something like global warming, opinions are pretty divided within the skeptical movement on that issue, although I think there's probably more skeptics who agree that global warming is happening. But that's like the one issue where we will get emails from our listeners who will characterize us as being true believers of the global warming mythology.
Right.
Even though we've been pretty, ourselves on the show, we've been kind of lukewarm on the issue and have had a somewhat of a range of opinions. That there aren't many issues where skeptics who agree with us on most other issues would characterize us in that way, unless there's this political or ideological dimension to the question.
To anybody listening, I hasten to add that there's this sort of discussion doesn't happen very much in the What Do I Do Next project, which is really about practical things.
Right, right.
I think you put your finger right on it. It is an ideological divide that separates in terms of belief or in terms of acceptance of science, divides one group of skeptics from another. The question, I think, is, does the community of skeptics have a greater amount of skepticism toward climate science than do climate scientists? My perception is that maybe we do, in which case that is a terrible, terrible, terrible problem for an organization or, a movement or whose only reason to exist is to support and promote the methods of science. If we're serious about that epistemology, then we should never be in a position where we are more skeptical of the science than are the scientists involved. Particularly because, we're lay people. That's the bottom line. I'm not a climatologist. I'm not a neurologist. If I want to form a position on neurology, I have to look at what the prevailing current of opinion among people who study the brain.
And that's essentially been our position on global warming on this podcast, is we're not so much giving you our opinion as saying this is the consensus of climatologists and geologists and whatever and relevant scientists.
Yeah, but Steve, what about that one guy out in the Midwest that's, that's what we always deal with.
Right.
We always get the, yeah, but there's one guy that says this or that. And this is one of the points that really gets me, is that it's like, this is one of those things I hate to repeat all the time, but whatever the consensus is, whatever the state-of-the-art information is, that's going to be what I believe in at the time. What could we do that's better than that?
That's the only responsible position for skeptics. I mean, there will always be that one guy, who says that HIV is not connected to AIDS, you know,
right,
and he may
right.
be a guy with impeccable credentials. He may have a group of followers who also have credentials. But what really matters is that he is out of step with the prevailing current of opinion among experts. And, you know, as a non-expert, I have no choice but to defer to that prevailing current.
Yeah, although the only, I think they would probably defend their position by saying that if there's a systematic problem with the scientific community on a specific issue because they are being overly influenced by politics, then the consensus may get it wrong. Although I would say then the burden of proof is on them to show that there is a systematic problem in the scientific community that is enough to invalidate the consensus of opinion, which I haven't seen personally.
And the problem is that that exact same argument is made by all deniers. You know,
right.
It's made by the people who, you know, creationists will say there is a systematic institutional bias of well-heeled biologists who have to protect their funding and are therefore suppressing the truth of creationism.
Right.
And that's true for every similar argument.
Yeah, absolutely, which is why I said the burden of proof is on them to show that that's not just an excuse for believing what they want to believe and dismissing the scientific consensus, which is what it comes down to.
So, Daniel, I like the Junior Skeptic a lot. Like, I've been a fan of it ever since I picked up Skeptic magazine, and I'm just curious. It's really cool. I mean, it's such a great idea, and I'm really into the idea of teaching children about critical thinking and skepticism. So I am definitely a big supporter of what you do there. And I just want to know, how did you get started with that? Like, where'd the idea come from? And also talk to me about one or two of the projects you have going on with the children's books.
Well, Junior Skeptic is my baby nowadays, but I'm a latecomer to it. I've been doing it since 2002, but it predates that by a few years. It was created by Pat Lindsay, the art director and co-publisher of Skeptic magazine. It's harder to write for kids than it is to write for adults, a lot harder in my view. You know, the illustration burden is enormous for Junior Skeptic. Those covers will take, you know, 2 or 3 man weeks of effort. But I love doing it. You know, the minute I saw it, I thought, there's a project I love. And when one day I got the chance to take my own swing at it, I was just overjoyed.
You know, I what's funny about you mentioning the artwork, and that I just found out tonight that you do it. I didn't see your name anywhere on there. I don't think I ever even looked to see who the artist was, but I absolutely remember several times in multiple issues, like looking at the artwork and like saying to myself that whoever did it must have had a lot of fun, because I could tell that you were enjoying yourself. I don't know. I could just see that in the way you did it.
Thanks. We love doing it. Me and Jim Smith, the guy who works with me here in the Junior Skeptic Studio on the art, and it's a hoot. You know, when I was a kid involved in art, I was doing dinosaurs and superheroes and aliens and stuff like that. The idea that I actually grew up to do that stuff professionally is, you know, it's just fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, that's cool. You're lucky.
Yeah, obviously, everyone always thinks it's very important to promote their ideology to children, right? Because they're the next generation.
Yeah.
So, and skeptics are no different. We obviously want to teach critical thinking and a love for science in children, and that's pretty non-controversial. So, I think the Junior Skeptic is wonderful, but I'm just wondering how many kids are getting Skeptic magazine or getting access to it there, or do you think that is a sort of a problem in marketing? And do you have plans on getting it online or in a format that would be marketed more directly to kids?
Well, you just covered a lot of meat right there. It is true that kids are the second audience for Junior Skeptic. It's the kind of unstated major premise of the project. The first audience are, you know, adult academic readers of Skeptic who turn to it first as kind of like the comics. And then hopefully many of them pass those on to their students and their kids and their, you know, nieces and nephews. But it is locked up inside an adult publication, so we do want to free it up. Now, possibly by the time this is out, although probably not for a week or two, I'll be putting up a sample story online so you can read it in PDF. There is nothing like that right now, although there is a Junior Skeptic wing of skeptic.com you can look at.
Mm-hmm. All right, I have two more quick questions for Daniel. One, are you going? You going to TAM?
Yeah, I'll be at TAM. I'll also be at Dragon Con.
Okay, cool.
TAM is like Woodstock for guys like us. You know, it's just I wouldn't miss it for the world.
My other question is, just out of curiosity, what pseudoscience bothers you the most?
Oh, that's a tough one. I can tell you the ones that bother me the least. I love cryptozoology. I have a real deep sympathy for cryptozoology. I love monsters. The ones that really stick in my craw, if we discount semi-serious topics like climate change, it would be in the alternative medicine realm. Homeopathy just drives me totally bananas. I mean, it's just like, how on earth did that load of magic horse shit get the market penetration that it has? It wasn't true when I was a kid. When I was a kid, if somebody said something about homeopathy, the room would say, what? It was totally obsolete. It was lost almost. It was a sort of fringe thing. But now it's everywhere. My vet recommends it. My midwife recommends it. Everybody recommends it.
I have a bad feeling that homeopathy is just here for the long haul.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It was great to have you finally.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thanks, Talk Daniel. To you soon, man.
See ya.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, bogus and fictitious. Then I challenge my skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Ready.
Just do it.
Barely. Here we go.
Yeah.
Item number one. New research suggests that vitamin D supplementation may exacerbate autoimmune disease.
I knew it.
Item number two, a new study finds that treating asymptomatic acid reflux can significantly improve asthma symptoms.
I knew it.
And item number three, scientists have discovered a possible mechanism to pacify rather than kill harmful bacteria in order to treat or prevent bacterial infections.
I didn't know that.
Not a lot of people know that.
All right. So what are you asking, Steve? What are we doing? Was this a podcast? What is this?
Rebecca, go first.
Oh, man. I'd like to point out that my laptop was stolen. And how many more weeks can I use that as an excuse for not being up on my science news?
Two.
Negative one. So it's time to shut up, you.
But I haven't gotten my new one yet. I haven't read any of these, which makes it very difficult.
You have to actually use your skeptical skills.
We all know I don't have those. Let's be honest.
Then use your kung fu skills.
Vitamin D supplements may make autoimmune diseases worse.
That's
plausible. I guess I can see how. I mean, a lot of people underestimate the effect that vitamins can have on their bodies. They just assume that it's always going to be good for them. But we've seen that too much vitamin A, for instance, can cause problems. So why not vitamin D? So that's okay. I can buy that. Asymptomatic acid reflux. Treating it can significantly improve asthma. Yeah, I can buy that too, because acid reflux could screw with your throat, which could make asthma worse. So treating it could fix it. So yeah, okay, I'm into that too. A possible mechanism to pacify rather than kill harmful bacteria in order to treat or prevent bacterial infections. That's probably the craziest one, which makes me think that one's true and you just put it in there to throw us off, because taming bacteria is wild, to say the least. Like, that's a cool idea. It's between the first one and the third one for me, and I'm going to take a shot in the dark, and I'm going to say the vitamin D one is actually wrong because you're trying to throw us off.
Okay.
There.
Okay, Evan?
All right, well, vitamin D exacerbating autoimmune disease.
By the way, there's a vaguely medical theme to these items this week, if you hadn't picked that up.
Yeah, that is true. And then the study finding that treating asymptomatic acid reflux can significantly improve asthma symptoms. And then the mechanism to pacify rather than kill harmful bacteria in order to treat or prevent bacterial infections. That's the most plausible, I think, of the three. Therefore, I'm torn between the vitamin D and the asymptomatic acid reflux.
Well, stop copying me, Evan.
Oh, I wasn't listening to you, so I have no idea what you said.
Maybe you should have.
I'm going to copy Rebecca.
Well, I mean, Rebecca, I mean, I'm going to follow you. I think you're correct in that the vitamin D supplementation exacerbating autoimmune disease is the fiction this week.
Okay, Bob.
I guess I could see a connection between the asymptomatic acid reflux and asthma. I can make a loose connection there. Pacifying bacteria rather than killing it. What an incredible idea that is. Very interesting. I'm not sure how they would go about it. How would you prevent bacteria from doing what bacteria do? I'm not aware of it doesn't mean that there's nothing. I think that, yeah, this is just the wacky one that we're supposed to have a reflex, a knee-jerk reaction, like, oh, no way, and pick it. I'm curious to see the details on that one. That would be pretty interesting. The first one is the one, the vitamin D and autoimmune. I'm not just familiar enough with vitamin D and autoimmune disease to see any connection. So I'm going to go with that one. This is a tricky one. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
You know, I'm not so sure about that one being the fake. So I'm going to go to the second one. A new study finds that treating asymptomatic acid reflux can significantly improve asthma symptoms. I could see how that. I mean, I don't really see the plausibility of that. What could acid reflux do? I mean, unless the acid is getting into your lungs and damaging your lungs, and I've never heard of that, but. And boy, I think you'd feel that. And scientists have discovered a possible mechanism to pacify rather than kill harmful bacteria in order to treat or prevent bacterial infections. I'm going to say that one is the fake.
Okay, so you all agree that a new study finds that treating asymptomatic acid reflux can significantly improve asthma symptoms. And that one is the fiction.
No!
No! You
that one's a fiction.
No!
Clean sweep.
Oh!
Nice.
No!
You bastard.
No. Oh. That's what I get for not listening to Rebecca.
For the last 20 years...
don't start with that.
The thinking was that, in fact, treating acid reflux would improve asthma symptoms. But there recently was a large study to actually test this notion, and they found that treating acid reflux did not in any way improve asthma symptoms.
Well, screw that.
Leading to a change in the recommendations because science-based practitioners actually change what they do based upon new scientific evidence. The change of recommendations to no longer prescribe heartburn or acid reflux medications for asthmatics unless they have symptoms of acid reflux. So obviously, you can still treat acid reflux if it's symptomatic, but there's no reason to treat it if it's asymptomatic just on the thinking that it's going to improve the asthma because the study showed that it doesn't.
Man, I'm never relying on kung fu again
I know. When you go back and think about all of like the flips that Rebecca did to try to figure Steve out, like you just totally screwed up this week.
I put a lot of effort into those kung fu style.
All the flips, all the turning.
You outmaneuvered yourself.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
Getting to number one, new research suggests that vitamin D supplementation may exacerbate autoimmune disease. That, of course, is science.
Now, that's obviously
very
true.
Interesting. It's actually and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast a couple of times. In the last few years, there's been this increasing research showing a association between low vitamin D levels and autoimmune diseases like MS and rheumatoid arthritis and other things. So the thinking being, well, having a low vitamin D causes or exacerbates autoimmune disease. Therefore, we should supplement with vitamin D. And this actually led to, in part, increasing the recommendations for vitamin D levels and vitamin D supplementation. And I was right there with everybody else. That's what the evidence shows. It seems like a pretty plausible scenario. But science is never as straightforward as it seems. So yes, low vitamin D levels correlate with autoimmune disease, but guess what? It's possible that the autoimmune disease is lowering the vitamin D levels as a reactive thing, not the other way around. And in fact, increasing or supplementing the vitamin D may therefore exacerbate the autoimmune disease. Here's what happens, and this is some research that and review of research being published by a team out of the California-based nonprofit Autoimmunity Research Foundation. And what they found is that supplemental vitamin D, which is not the exact same form of vitamin D that is made by just exposing your skin to the sun, right? That this affects many, many targets, right? It doesn't just affect calcium, which is the classic or old thinking. They found that it can affect up to 913 different genes. in the body. One of the things it does is it decreases immune activity, which you think might be an advantage for autoimmune disease. But what this allows certain bacteria to spread more easily. And in the long run, these bacteria, especially specific ones that are implicated in driving autoimmune processes, these bacterial populations which are allowed to proliferate because of vitamin D and its inhibition, supplemental vitamin D and its inhibition of the immune system, then drives autoimmune diseases and maybe other diseases as well. And then as a reaction to this, part of the body's defense mechanism is to reduce vitamin D levels. And therefore, by supplementing it, you're interfering with the body's own attempt to regulate itself, and that could drive the autoimmune disease. Isn't that interesting?
Pretty cool.
Yes.
I'm so fascinated.
You lost me when
in other words, it's about two layers more complex than everybody thought. And the caution here is that correlation's not causation, right? It's not necessarily causation. And the fact that it seemed like a no-brainer. Low vitamin D levels, autoimmune disease. Supplement the vitamin D. But it turns out that could be the exact opposite thing that you should do. Very interesting. Which means also that, number three, scientists have discovered a possible mechanism to pacify rather than kill harmful bacteria in order to treat or prevent bacterial infections is also science.
Wow.
And this is
fairly
cool.
Very cool.
So this is research that is being published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And what they found is that certain bacteria that are normally present as part of the bacterial flora of the body, right? So we are colonized with all kinds of bacteria. We are an ecosystem of bacteria that work with us and are friendly and keep out bad bacteria. But sometimes the bacteria that is normally present in our GI system, for example, can become pathological. It will turn into an infection rather than just, you know, a healthy colonization. And what they found is that can be triggered sometimes by certain physiological stress situations, like if you are getting surgery, you're otherwise sick and in the hospital, for example. And what these researchers did is they were able to link this with low levels of phosphate. A specific bacteria that they studied, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, so Pseudomonas is the bacteria, when it is fed a high phosphate diet, it behaves normally. But on a low phosphate diet, it actually becomes pathological.
Wow.
It turns into a deadly bacteria. They fed it to worms, and the Pseudomonas fed the high phosphate, did not kill the worms. The Pseudomonas on the low phosphate diet killed the worms, became pathological. So this could lead to strategies like supplementing phosphate or using drugs that deliver phosphate to the GI system or where the bacteria are that will pacify them, that will keep them in their passive and benign state and keep them from triggering an infection.
Yeah, but Steve, I wonder what the percentage is of times that a doctor prescribes, say, an antibiotic for a bacterial infection. I mean, how often is it because of bacteria that have entered a nasty state and are not in their current, you know, their normal benign state? I mean, it might be a very small percentage of times.
That's a very good question. It's obviously not all bacteria, and it remains to be seen for which strains of bacteria this kind of strategy will be possible. But, for example, Pseudomonas, the one that they investigated,
right,
is a very common hospital infection, and it's a very serious hospital infection when it occurs.
Okay.
So even if you can attack a few common hospital strains of bacterial infections, that could have a huge impact.
Yeah, excellent. Cool. I love bacteria.
Oh, my God.
Well, some bacteria, you mean.
Let me tell you something.
Why
you ever get food poisoning, you ever get food poisoning, you will not love bacteria.
You're still waiting for the bacteria that will make you fart bananas.
Ew. Like an entire banana?
No, the banana smell.
It's not a fart,
I thought you
meant.
That's
a poo.
What kind of banana? Cavendish?
Or
plantain.
Gros Michel?
The atheist nightmare.
Plantain?
Don't start, Bob, on the whole banana thing again. God.
I'm over it.
Not the banana hubbub again.
I didn't know Bob had a banana thing.
Bob's been obsessed with bananas recently since
Who gets obsessed with bananas?
He's been peeling them with his toes, too. What's up with that,
Bob? Bob and Ray Comfort are obsessed with bananas.
It was, fascinating.
How it feels in my hand.
It was such a fascinating topic. When you learn the details, you get sucked into a web of intrigue.
Your
it was awesome.
Sucked into a web of bananas.
Right. Real brief, there was a banana.
You know what? Just skip it. I don't want to know.
Two bananas walking down the road. One turns to the other and says,
the bananas we eat today are a pale comparison to the ones of 100 years ago, which was a different variety, which was much richer, creamier, and tastier. But they went extinct. Not extinct, they went out of production because of a fungus. Fungal infection. And the same thing might happen to the bananas we have today. We may lose the banana
Cavendish
crop that we have today.
And then after that, we might just have to eat banana-shaped rocks.
Right.
Hey, yo, my, what banana was that?
Anyway, Evan.
Oh, that's me.
Hi. Yes, Evan. So,
who's that,
noisy?
Who's that noisy?
Evan, can you play us last week's Who's That Noisy?
Sure. Here it is.
But for me, leaving science behind when I did was a very, very tough decision, but I did. As I say, you have to make up your mind at the age of about 16, and I went onto the arts side. And really, for a whole period, my interest in science kind of languished. And I want to tell you a little bit about what rekindled it. Now,
okay, and that was, of course, the infamous Douglas Adams.
Douglas Adams.
I've heard that name before.
That was an easy
familiar. I wonder. Oh, well. It escapes me. He wrote a book or something called Something
Couple,
Guide to Something.
Even.
The author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Awesome.
Awesome series of books.
What a great book.
But if you haven't read it, I recommend that you listen to him narrate the series on book on tape.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
And I'll bet you the listeners who got it correctly may have been the ones who actually had the book on tape. I wouldn't be surprised.
Right,
that's
right.
True. That's how I immediately recognized it. But Steve, even if you've read it 100 times, I would say listen to him read his work.
Yeah,
he was a total master. He brings it to life, you know, well beyond what your imagination can do. He's just an incredible narrator.
And
he was
the inspiration for the name of our podcast, which is why we occasionally pay homage to the great one.
The great one.
The great
and,
one.
And the winner, or the first one to guess correctly, Rueful Rabbit.
Ooh, Rueful Rabbit.
And
awesome.
From the message boards.
Very alliterative.
I recognize that name. Well done, Rueful One.
Good job.
So, Evan, Rabbit. Hit us with this week's Who's That Noisy.
Is everyone ready?
Oh, yeah.
So ready.
The hell?
Here it is.
That's Rebecca typing on her keyboard.
while she's taking a bath.
Yeah.
that's really how I lost my last laptop.
Okay. Thank you, Evan. Thank you. Jay.
Yeah.
Please close out the show with your fine selection of skeptical quote.
This is a quote from, does anybody know who Hypatia is?
Hypatia?
No.
She's a porn star. Yeah, she's a
porn
star.
No, I don't. I know who Hypatia is, but I have no idea who Hypatia is.
Okay. Does anybody know who Hypatia of Alexandria is?
Yeah, she's that girl from Alexandria.
Yeah.
The last curator of the Great Library of Alexandria.
An entire interview with a guy who wrote a book about
Brian Trent. What do you mean?
A guy.
Right. Brian Trent.
Yeah, Brian.
He is a guy.
She meet a horrible, horrible demise? Like they strung her up for heresy
butchered
or something.
By fundamentalists.
She was killed by a Christian mob.
As Carl Sagan relates in Cosmos, the flesh was flayed from her bones by abalone shells. Or with abalone shells.
Abalone.
Abalone.
I hate when that
too
happens.
Too late.
That's right, Evan. You and me.
All right. So what did Hypatia have to say, Jay?
She said, reserve your right to think, for even to think wrongly is better than not to think at all. And, I have a second quote, she also said or wrote, to teach superstitions as truth is a most terrible thing. Hypatia!
And Jay, who sent us those quotes or recommended them to us?
of Alexandria. Phil Plait.
That's right, our friend Phil Plait.
Hey,
from somewhere cool. in the U.S.
sent us those quotes. So thanks, Phil.
Boulder, thanks, Colorado.
Phil will be in New York, and people can see him give a talk at Hayden Planetarium on Monday the 20th.
Oh, that's interesting.
FYI.
Well, thanks, everyone.
Thank you,
Steve.
Good time, as always.
Nice time. Good stuff.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.